As you can see, if you are looking at the broadcast player's title, the title of the discussion today is Time of Transition. Transition is something that is continuously going on. It is something which is a constant, something which is a never-changing product of the reality in which we live. Now, although you would technically define a transition as a space between one stable reality to the other, in fact, there is no such thing as a stable reality. For example, if you're making a website and it looks one way, and you have a goal to make it look another way, as it is changing or transforming from the original design to the new design, you would call it a transition. Now, because we're dealing with material things, material objects, the design can look one way, the design can look another way. So, obviously, there is a point in between where the design is something else. It's transiting. It's under development. It's evolving. Let's take another example of me flying to Russia. I'm going to get on the airplane, and I'm going to be in the U.S., and then I'm going to physically relocate myself to Russia. So while I'm in that process of flying, I'm transiting from one physical place to another physical place. Now, the transiting that we are speaking about is a movement of location. So I'll be in one place, and then if you say I'm going to another place, I will be transiting. But the other place is also not my final destination. I'm also going to Moscow. So you could say I'm transiting from St. Petersburg to Moscow. Or you could say I'm transiting from the United States to Moscow. You could disregard completely St. Petersburg and say my transit is from United States to Moscow. Or if you want, you could disregard completely Moscow and St. Petersburg and simply say, I'm transiting back and forth to the airport. I'm just going back and forth to the airport. I'm going to the airport and back. That's all I'm doing. I'm transiting back and forth between the airport. One could also say, I'm transiting from my previous lifetime to my next lifetime. One could also say, I'm transiting through thousands of lifetimes. One could then have to say, I started somewhere, and I'm going to end somewhere. Where did I start? Well, some people say the spiritual world, some people say other things. Where am I going to end? Some people say the spiritual world, some people say other things. Transit is a relative term. It depends on how you define the beginning points and the starting points. If you talk in terms of eternality, when you talk in terms of eternality, you're transiting all the time. Every single moment is a transit. Nothing is fixed. If you think about the subatomic realm. Okay, naturally, we can't think about the subatomic realm because we don't really have any contact with the subatomic realm. In the subatomic realm, everything is basically chaos. Things are just moving in all directions, spinning this way and that way. Making sense of the subatomic realm is not something that the human mind can do. It doesn't matter if you're Stephen Hawking or you're Albert Einstein. You can't make sense of the subatomic realm. So ultimately, because it is always in transit, it is never one state and then it moves to some other state which is stable for some period of time. There is no such thing, even in matter, as stability. Just think about that. Everything is constantly changing. If you look at our bodies are an amazing biochemical organism made of an unlimited number of chemical reactions that are taking place moment by moment. Just every time I breathe, oxygen is being exchanged in my lungs to the bloodstream. My food is in a constant state of assimilation and digestion. My water is being absorbed and created into urine or transformed into urine, which is in the process of leaving me. Even if I don't eat, I don't drink, there's still a using up of fat reserves, or the reserves of B12, or the reserves of vitamin C, or the reserves of the CoQ10 vitamin. Our hormones are constantly in the state of excreting their substances. So our entire physiological mechanism is always in motion. Indeed, if there was no transiting of the blood, we would die. If our nervous system was not continuously making everything in flux, in other words, that I would feel and I would cause actions and I would have consciousness, my senses are working, I would not be alive. So the idea of static existence is an illusion. We create a kind of relativity to say, well, as long as I have a steady income, as long as I'm basically healthy, as long as I'm not hungry, as long as my family is basically safe, and so on, I have a stable life. But it's not static. It's also in transit. Our relationships are always in transit. They move moment by moment. Have you ever seen how you can have a perfectly good relationship with somebody one moment? And all you have to do is say the wrong thing at the wrong time, or at the right time, and instantly that relationship, if only for a short period of time, changes. Even if it's your most beloved partner, all you have to do is make the mistake of slightly insulting them by accident, or saying something just a little bit, like every man knows when his wife asks him that very dangerous question, "Do I look fat in these pants?" You know, when you hear that question, there's no way on earth you're going to answer honestly. Because whatever you think, you must say, "Not at all. You look great." Even if you think that way, you have to be very careful how you answer. Because you have to say it very convincingly. This is a joke, of course. But it's kind of fun to think about how what we take for granted as stability is actually a series of constant transitions from one moment to the next. And yet it's quite interesting how people, all of us, I am especially this way, we yearn for, we thirst for stability. We want things to be static. I personally like things which don't change. Dependable, always working the right way. Perfect arrangements that are just right all the time. But it's never like that. But we like such things. We, who are living in a state of constant change, idealistically look for states which are just perfect. Therefore, the idea of a spiritual world which never changes is very attractive, because we think that because the material world, as we've defined it, is always changing, the spiritual world must be the opposite and never change. But that's not what spirit really is. Spirit is constantly moving. It's in motion. Spiritual energy is always in motion. Even if you look at the pastimes of Radha and Krishna and the gopis, and it's filled with talk. It's filled with exchanges. It's filled with humor and jokes and tricks and plots and all kinds of things to make it interesting because of the changing that's going on. Because when nothing changes, you're dealing with dead matter that never moves. But even then, that's not stable, because matter gradually disintegrates. So then you would have to define unchanging as eternally dead matter that never changes. But that's a contradiction in terms. So you couldn't say that. So a smarter form of definition would be, everything is always in transit at all times, because that's the nature of existence. There is no such thing as unchangeable. Everything is transforming. So if we were to make definitions or look for that which is unchangeable, that's simply a mental concoction to somehow make ourselves feel better about something. In reality, it is not related to spirituality. It is not related to the Supreme. And it's certainly not related to us in our lives. It's just some idea. When I was writing the title, Time of Transition, I didn't really want to speak about this existential, metaphysical point which discusses the very basis of life. But it came to be that this is kind of a fun thing to talk about. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's something which is fun. It's something which is philosophically attractive. But it's not very practical. Now, that which is practical is, when we look at reality right now, we look at the world, we look at the headlines in the news services, we look at the events that are taking place in the world around us. And when we look at all these events, when we look at all of these political changes, technological changes, economic changes, we see that these things are in a major state of transformation. This is my personal analysis. I can't guarantee it. I can't guarantee that it's 100% accurate, or that even the weight or the significance of these changes is as important and significant as I've stated it, or will state it. But I feel it in my bones. You know that statement? You feel it in your bones. Do you have that in Russian? Okay. You feel it in your bones. It's something which you just feel very deeply. It's resonating on that cellular level. I feel there is an enormous transformation going on. Now, when sometimes people talk about such transformations, they say it's happening on the highest spiritual levels, or they say it's happening as it descends from the etheric realm as it's imprinted on this world. I have said that too, because that's actually the way such practically universal shifts take place, or at least globally they take place. Because people are not only starting to think or be aware, but they're understanding, probably for the first time in a long time, that they feel something is transforming in themselves, how they think, how they react, how they relate. It's almost as if they're just getting a vision that there's a shift happening here, and they like to be part of it, but they're not really sure. I'll describe that better. These kinds of shifts or transitions are things which you don't find in history books. You don't find in history books. Let's take, for example, the time of Lord Chaitanya. This is a very significant historical event. It's a historical event because it took place at a particular period of time. It took place in a very specific location with very specific people. Now, how did Lord Chaitanya's appearance and the transformations that took place affect the economy? How did it affect the political arrangements? How did it affect the events of human relationship and activity? You don't really see that in history. You don't see even in Indian history. And don't forget, at this time, there was a lot of people writing about the events of that time. If you go back to the time of Lord Krishna's appearance, if we could just talk about that for a second, regardless of whether or not we believe that was the way it was written, you'll find there's one historical account. You don't find a lot of historical accounts. That at that time, writing was very rare. The means by which the writing could be recorded was very difficult. Even if there were other writings, they were not preserved. After all, we're talking about so many thousands of years. A leaf can last maybe 10 years, unless it's very carefully preserved. So, but Lord Chaitanya's time, we have a lot of historians. We have a lot of people writing about it. We have people writing about it from all different points of view. And these literatures are there in all different indigenous languages in India. Now, you don't find the direct connection between, shall we say, political transformations or economic transformations, or the transformations in the police department, or in the way in which people communicated, or the way in which agriculture took place. You don't find direct connections. I mean a direct connection, something like you would see Krishna was on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and because of Draupadi, millions of people are dying. That is an event which impacts politically to the highest possible level. I mean, when all of a sudden 4 or more million men disappear, as Maharaj Yudhisthira was lamenting, there's widows, there's orphans, there's economic chaos. You know, this is an event which goes very to the core of a country's existence. When all of a sudden the most mature and able-bodied persons in a country are no longer there. Just look at Finland in World War II. Finland was fighting against Russians who were trying to come in. And on their western border, they put all of their mature men. Most of them were killed. Since that time, Finns have been very melancholy, very serious people, and there was an enormous lack of men. It transformed the whole country. Women took a whole new role. The balance of the whole country was changed irrevocably. So this is a very significant historical event. But if you look at Lord Chaitanya's time, you don't see such one-to-one direct connections. Now, does that mean there weren't any? Or does that mean Lord Chaitanya's appearance was not significant? Not at all. It only means that Lord Chaitanya's appearance did not affect the history of the time in a manner which historical kind of minded people, historians, could directly link one to one. Just look at how the whole period of reformation, of restoration, of all this renaissance, of reform and renaissance in Europe. It happened at a parallel time. America was discovered. Well, okay, by Europeans. Actually, Vikings were here long before Columbus ever came here. Columbus. But it's like, anyway, who cares? The idea being that parallel to Lord Chaitanya's appearance, there was a significant transformation of culture, of awareness. Even in those times, you have astronomical awareness shifting. Challenges were being made to the church and the church's monopoly on the way you're supposed to think about reality. Basically, things were challenged. And the ideas which were considered to be irrevocable started shifting. Art, music, culture. It gave rise to transformations which so deeply changed the entire history and direction of the entire world. Just think about that. You had a world which was basically defined as, in medieval terms, primitive forms of technology, primitive forms of social arrangement, practically the elite and slaves, with a few in between who had some power over money. You had some political arrangements which were exploitive, did not give allowance to transform. Everything was basically very restrictive. You were not encouraged to think. You were not encouraged to evolve personally. Now, even during the Renaissance and all of this, not many people were encouraged either. However, there was this phenomena that some people started to break free from the bondage of the time. Some people started to look in totally new directions. My proposal is that Lord Chaitanya's appearance, although it had a fabulous, magnificent impact on the spirituality of an entire continent, of people who just tasted that love which Lord Chaitanya shared to each and every individual. The reverberations of this resonated throughout, especially Europe. And the resonations of this caused transformations to take place, which affected the entire course of history from that time. It gave birth to an age of enlightenment, it was called, and an age in which the individual could think again, an age in which the man's awareness was considered to be of a significant value in his life, a time in which growth was not only encouraged, but which was applauded publicly. Fabulous things started to take place. Now, if you think about it, this change of thought, this transformation, especially this movement of people to colonize America, South America, Canada, there was this very interesting creation of the steam engine in the early 1700s. As man with man's very inventive mind wanted to make things easier, wanted to give facility to expand more. Now, remember, until this period of the expansion in Europe, there was no attempt to transform mechanistically society. There was not really an attempt to transform it religiously. Everything was very static philosophically. Everything was pretty static in the scientific front. Anything that was not of the way the church wanted it to be was crushed and repressed. So you have this situation where actually in historical time, over a 100-year period, a very radical shift took place. A shift in the mentality of an entire continent. And you can understand this took place. I don't want to make this a historical lesson, and neither do I want to get into the whole development of modernity, the modernization of society with the invention of the steam engine. I don't want to get into that. But what I wanted to really make this point was, you have this incredibly important event, Lord Chaitanya's appearance. Now, when people talk about Lord Chaitanya as the Yuga avatar, you know, the one who is the one who defines the age, usually it is in such a simplistic fashion. I never personally felt happy with it. He brought the chanting of the holy name. Okay, hey, I like to chant as much as the next person. And hey, it's great. But I don't really see that about Lord Chaitanya's appearance. After all, the holy name was already there. There were people chanting all the time. And even Lord Chaitanya himself, of course, did a lot of chanting, but I mean, even nowadays, you don't see so much chanting everywhere. You see some bhajans coming up. You see people like Krishna Das popularizing it and stuff. But this is still like little groups here and there. There's something else I wanted to speak about Lord Chaitanya's significance, and I don't think in any way this diminishes the importance of that aspect of the spiritual gift of Lord Chaitanya, not at all. But I think that the significance of him being a Yuga avatar, if we wish to believe it or not, it doesn't matter, is underestimated. I think religious people who are of the Gaudiya tradition have seriously underestimated the impact of Lord Chaitanya and the impact of what it was that manifested from his appearance. I feel what it was taking away the power from the, shall we call it, oppressive, monolithic understandings or groups which pressed upon the individual. If you think about it, even if the Yuga Dharma, the religious principle of the age is temple worship. Think about this. It requires a temple. So you're dependent on a temple. You have to go to a temple which is run by priests who dictate what is happening in the temple. Think about that. That is an organization that you must have, you must participate in to perform the spiritual processes. That has been translated through time as churches, as organized religions, as any group which is creating a facility which we depend on, which we require for our spirituality to unfold, to evolve. But Lord Chaitanya was quite different. Even if you accept just chant, just, I mean like singularly, as the Yuga Dharma, the chanting. I don't accept that, but let's use it as an example. And again, when I say I don't accept that, I don't mean that's the only thing. I mean there are many more things which have been pushed aside as significant. But even if you only accept that one thing, think about it. All that is required is you. Ultimately, to chant just needs you. You don't need a temple. In fact, many Babaji's in India don't go to temples, don't want to be in temples. They want to just sit there in Navadvip somewhere and chant alone. Even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati did not want any of this. He sat on the bank of the Ganges chanting. It was a businessman who came and convinced him that he needed to start an organization. Now, when one has such a power that the religious principle of the age depends only on oneself, ultimately, one has complete freedom to develop spiritually. And that is fabulous. And if I choose to place myself together with others to chant together, that's my choice. If you think that you must chant together with others, I say, let's look at the example of Lord Chaitanya. When he was in Srivas Thakur's house, he only allowed very specific people to chant in that group. He said, you can be here, you cannot. Or Swarodamadar Goswami or others like that would make such decisions. Now, you have that individual power. Anybody, I will chant with them, I won't chant with them. Again, you're fully under control of this particular spiritual process. That is a very, very significant shift. That is a very significant shift away from the dependency on groups, the dependency on stable, monolithic groups. And what do stable, monolithic groups have? Hierarchical understandings means God's male, God's the Father has sons, the sons inherit the power of the Father, the sons have an organization, the powerful representatives inherit the power of the sun. You follow in such a line. Hierarchy. Man is powerful, woman is weak, etc. You get the point. Hierarchical understanding is thrown away in Lord Chaitanya's simplicity of the spiritual activity. Look at his life. At the end, he was alone in a room. No dependency on anything. No dependency on anybody. No dependency whatsoever. His life, him and politics separated. King separated. Nobody controlled him. But love attracted him. So all that counted was the love, the loving relationship, the sharing of love, the spirituality of it, the sharing of food, the sharing of association, according to our choice. Do you understand this? How significant this was. And at the same time, historically, this is exactly what the Renaissance was all about. The artist alone in his room painting, even without recognition, expressing himself. The composers expressing themselves, even without recognition. The playwrights expressing themselves. As a cultural phenomena, everything transformed. The individual becoming elevated. It was a transformation. And at the same time, religious reformation, revolt against the original religious traditions. At the same time, political transformation, French revolutions. That revolution put such a mark into the historical template that people could get together and overthrow monarchy. Unheard of! Do you realize what a significant political event that was? And then all the people, all these oppressed kind of people from England, from Germany, from Scandinavia, from other, they sailed to the New World, no longer bound by the pieces of land they were in. And then they said, no more being oppressed by some colonizers, some empires. And then the transformation of machinery, of the original event which made technology possible, the capturing of power. Benjamin Franklin and electricity on the key of the kite. And you have now a possibility to be free from the limitations of the strength or muscle of man. In other words, we have a direct correlation between Lord Chaitanya's appearance and the significant, most significant of all transformations that have ever taken place in any history that we are aware of. Think about that. And it's documented. Think about that. And then look at Lord Chaitanya and say, he was the Yuga avatar and he brought the chanting of the holy name. I mean, to say that is the biggest oversimplification. It practically becomes insulting. It's practically an insult to say that's what he did. Because Lord Chaitanya's impact on this planet was so far-reaching, so significant. It impacted every single thing that took place. You might say, as an argument, Okay, it would have happened anyway. Okay, now I challenge that. There is no difference between what happened for thousands of years and what was going on at Lord Chaitanya's time. No difference. Such transformations never took place in any way yet. Even if you talk about the appearance of Jesus Christ, you don't have such far-reaching transformations. What you really have is simply one of the emperors took it as a state religion 300 years later. You don't have transformation socially. You don't have transformation politically. You don't have transformation economically. You don't have transformation for the individual. But when Lord Chaitanya appeared, all of a sudden, although it had nothing else changed for thousands of years, and that's not an insignificant point, these transformations started in such a significant, fundamental way. My theory, if you will, is that Lord Chaitanya's presence was not related to just the chanting of the holy name. It was a transformation of the entire vibratory frequency of this planet. The entire vibratory frequency of every single aspect of life, every single little itsy-bitsy atom was transformed. And it's still going on. Now, let's look at, do you know anything? Well, you don't. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There's curves, different kinds of curves. You know, if you have a chart, and let's say you're talking about a curve. Well, this would be like a geometric curve. It's just geometrically increasing, you know, move one cell, go up one cell, move one cell, go up one cell, like that. That would be like a line. These are very steady curves or very steady lines or very steady forms of transformation. Then there's logarithmic curves, which just start gradually, and then all of a sudden start going way up. And depending on what kind of logarithmic formula it is, it will have a different kind of curve. Well, I say Lord Chaitanya's influence is like that. If you look at the world, more raw materials have been taken from this planet since World War II than all of history combined. Let's look at the climate change. I don't want to see it just as we're doing something bad, we have to change it. I want to see it one step outward. You make war, you get entangled. You can't win anymore by power. Think about that. You can't win anymore just by power. Just because you have an atom bomb doesn't mean you can win. Somebody else also has atom bombs. You can lose even if you win. You can't just march over a country with huge armies. Because then what do? You're stuck. And all it takes is one man, one woman with bombs. And chaos is going on. The power of group. You understand this theme? Let's go back to the theme, okay? The power of group is paralyzed by the individual. I'll repeat that because that's incredibly significant. The power of an enormous country is paralyzed by one individual who says, I'm not going to take that. I'm not talking good or bad. I'm just talking about the structure of what's going on. Control of the media. Big companies control everything. Not anymore. There's the internet. A girl on YouTube giving her commentary of life becomes one of the biggest stars in the world. Millions of people go to her broadcasts, which are just her and her webcam talking. the power of media giants undercut by one person with one camera and an internet connection. Look at the transformations. Now let's look at environmental change in another way. Now, all of this technological advancement, all of these fabulous things that are going on, also have byproducts. Radiation byproducts, chemical byproducts, the causing of deterioration of the chemical byproducts, and the deterioration of people's physical health, the long-term residual effects of these things creating debilitating diseases in old age. And as people live longer, the problem of living longer with a debilitating disease becomes much more significant. So transformations have to take place to deal with that. So we are in a position where the very thing which on this logarithmic curve, which has gone so fast since World War II, is the very thing which is causing us to lose the most valued possession we have, our beautiful planet and the health of those on it. So the whole thought process is now having to shift to the planet and the people on the planet. So global warming brings global awareness. And all of a sudden, individuals are working towards that goal. The price of oil going way up, but the creation of capitalism, and don't forget, capitalism is a very new thing in the sense that it is now. It's a very new thing. Previously, things were very different. I don't want to get into it, but you had like slaves and serfs and landowners. And maybe a few people who made utensils and things. Your slaves built your buildings. Capitalism is a very new thing historically. So this capitalism allows individuals who become aware to look at everything and say, price of gas going way up. Even if they're not very environmentally conscious, they think, price of gas going up? Hey, electric cars could be cool. Hydrogen cars could be cool. I could make a lot of money. So they're doing it. Now, do you know what kind of significance there would be? Because everybody's upset now with oil translating to cost, because it disturbs my pocket. So cars, the main reason we feel disturbed, becoming electric. Let's see it in another way. Electricity costs rise because the oil needed to generate electricity. Same problem, same situation. Capitalism. Let's use other forms of energy creation, transformation, new ways. What does it mean? We don't need oil. What does that mean? We're not milking the earth anymore. What does it mean? We're being compatible with earth. We have to, everybody thinking gradually in terms of money, but in ways which become beneficial to the earth. As we work in harmony with the earth, I don't care what your motive is. It is good for you. And people think about their health. They're trying to find out reasons why things are going on. Medical science is a monolith. It's the religion. It's the church of the modern age, the medical profession. The medical profession is the church of the modern age. You have to go to worship at the office of your physician, and you have to give a huge donation to the physician to do something for your health, even though the money you pay is totally out of proportion to the costs or value of this physician. So therefore, people, it's capitalism, see there's a possibility for alternative cures, alternative things. And so people are moving. And where alternative forms of medicine were the minority, they're now becoming mainstream. The monolith is being challenged. It's the same pattern again. Look at this over and over again. Monoliths are being challenged. This is the whole theme of Lord Chaitanya. He challenged the Qazi. In fact, his whole, shall we say, process disregarded entirely the political system of the time. Not even in opposition to it. It just completely disregarded it. So it had no longer control over him. Why? Because he was totally on another frequency. Look at this theme again and again resonating throughout the world in all respects. Do your own kind of sociological, economic, political research. See the tracks. See the trails of this resonance of Lord Chaitanya's revolution, of the transition that is going on due to Lord Chaitanya. Trace the tracks. You know what they say? Follow the money trail. See how this is affecting the flow of the money and how others are catching on to this and how individuals are catching on to this. Open source software. You can do everything with open source, free things. You can start to understand how community is arising on the same kind of wavelength of people as they evolve together. Look what we are doing right now in the same exact context. Formerly, for me to have a forum to reach out to you. And let's not take this lightly. When I used to go to Moscow, for instance, there were at least 3,000 people sometimes, or thousands in big auditoriums listening. That was the only way I could reach. To do that, people had to be mobilized from all over. There was a huge organization required. Find the hall, rent the hall, manage the hall, advertise the hall. People had to fly in, train in, bus in, walk in. But even worse, I had to be an accepted and recognized personality within an organization, a monolithic organization, which dictates what you should think, what I should think, what I should say, and what you should hear. Think about it. Everything controlled in a monolithic organization. Interesting. Now, what are we doing? Well, I'm talking to an awful lot of people out there. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people right now who are listening right now. You see, each of you are one little group of people, perhaps, but you're all over the world. The same thing that you're doing right now, wherever you are, other people are doing too. And this facility depends on, well, basically, a handful of people. Right now, what this is depending on is me and a server which many of you are donating for, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart for that, because you keep it going, all of you who support Hari Media. Sudha Dhani, who is working like mad all week long and who still translates for you in this wonderful way he does it. And you've got Gora, who just keeps together the whole Hari Media Net site. And I'm telling you, it's a handful of people. And thousands of people download these recorded lectures. What we are doing is not dependent on any monolith. I don't have to talk to you according to what is expected. You don't have to be afraid of hearing something that the monolith doesn't want you to hear. Of course, if you live in Germany and you're still in ISKCON, you are banned. Think about this. You are banned from listening to me. Forbidden. Because the monolith says it's bad for you. You should not do this. You can not do this. You are forbidden. And what do I care? Or what do you care? None of us care. We do not give a damn what the monolith says. Just think about that. Just think about that. We are doing what we think is right. This is the gift of this transformation, that monoliths no longer control us anymore. Facility is there, and it's transforming all the time. For individuals to make an impact, for individuals to transform everything individually, for individuals to have power, power which is beyond our capacity to understand the impact. What did Lord Chaitanya do? He was one person. And because of him being who he was, the impact of Lord Chaitanya's just life reverberates and is still reverberating and is transforming everything. We are all in transition. Where does it lead? I don't know. Where do you want it to lead? I don't know where it's going to go. Where do you want it to go? Where do we want it to go? But it's going. Oh, for sure, it's going. Because this is a time of transition. Things are transforming. And the power is moving away from monoliths and moving into the hands of individuals. And individuals are creating groups of individuals to transform further. And that transformation gives rise to individuals who transform further in that freedom of individual transformation. And our evolution is transforming in the capacities we have, in the power we have, in the feelings we have of being individuals who matter, individuals who have capacities, who love, and whose love matters, whose love counts, who are worthy of being loved, who reject this group monolithic idea that we are nothing, that we are servants, slaves, that we are not worthy. We are not good enough. We are whatever. You don't hear this from Lord Chaitanya. Even in that time when Chota Haridas did this imaginary offense, Chota Haridas, yes, it's an imaginary offense. Forget all of the difficulties of the situation, but just let's talk about his imaginary offense. He borrowed rice from an old lady who was one of the most significant devotees of Lord Chaitanya for Lord Chaitanya's lunch. It's an imaginary offense. There is nothing offensive about it. And Lord Chaitanya did not condemn it. Now the point is, it was supposed to have been an offense. He created this situation of it being an offense. But the only way he dealt with it was, I don't want to have this person in my association. Period. I choose not to associate with this person. He would not even have said why if the others were not pushing him. But why? Why are you doing this? He wouldn't answer. Finally, he said, okay, because somebody who acts like this is not acting properly, and I don't want him around. Doesn't even have to condemn the person personally. Do you understand this? It was so sophisticatedly, so maturely, so evolved, dealt with. I don't like what that person did, but I will just simply choose not to associate with them. What an evolved lesson. Okay, there may be so many problems with how we feel about what happened to Chota Haridas. But Chota Haridas and Lord Chaitanya worked it out later on. It was their arrangement. My point being, we don't have to feel bad. We don't have to feel condemned. We don't have to accept these things upon ourselves, which make us feel so badly, which keep us pushed down, which keep us so repressed. We can just act out of love as best we can. And if somebody chooses to condemn us, that's their situation. That's their problem. If we think we should change, fine. If some group condemns us, just push it aside. It is not required to accept such kinds of situations. We are not required to satisfy anyone. We are required to do one thing only, and that is to be true to ourselves, what we are, to have those relationships we wish to have, and nourish them, nurture them, according to our feelings, according to our love, according to our desires, and to move with the flow of global transformation, move with the flow of spiritual evolution, and just let it all grow. More than that, we have no obligation. And that means we do what we think is right in the best way we can, in the most spiritually evolved way, which is appropriate for ourselves and the situation we are in. What I wanted to do is start off with finishing my point about Lord Chaitanya. It was funny. I got involved in the point and I forgot to finish it with what it really was all about. The reason I mentioned that point of Chota Haridas was because I wanted to display how Lord Chaitanya dealt with this situation in a very individual manner. He did not throw the situation into a group environment. In other words, there was no statement to all of his devotees, you have to now avoid him totally because I'm doing it. Hello? Did you hear? Yeah, that you don't have to, you should not associate with him because I'm doing it. You should not associate with him because I'm not associating with him. And they actually kept coming back to him, trying to change his mind. What he did say was, if you keep insisting on trying to change my mind, I'm just going to go somewhere else. So the theme that I extracted from this, and again, this does not mean anyone else would do the same, and neither does it matter to me if anyone else would do the same. The theme I am extracting from this is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu made his own individual statement about a person, and as an individual, made his decision how he was going to relate with that individual. His decision was not made by the group of people around him. And even when the group of people around him tried to change his mind, he did not agree. He didn't tell them, if you associate with him, then you are bad. I won't speak to you anymore. These are very significant points. What he did say was that if you keep bothering me by pushing me to have to think the way you want, I'm going to go somewhere else where I can be peaceful. So this was the whole point of all of this discussion about this pastime. Just think of the significance of this. Just like if my discussion is being banned by some group in some geographical location, and the individuals don't have the choice. They are being forced to act. If they wanted to make another choice, they would face disciplinary action within a group. They are being dictated to. Lord Chaitanya, being the individual, bringing the emphasis to the individual, taking the power away from the group over the individual, said, I've made this decision. I'm sticking to my own decision. I don't want you telling me what I should do. I made this decision myself. There is such a world of difference between these two ways of looking at things. Yet groups claim to represent Lord Chaitanya, represent the Yuga Dharma, yet they don't see the subtlety of this message. And therefore, this particular pastime has never been understood by these groups. That's my opinion. They say that you should never act like this, and acharyas shouldn't act like that, and this was very serious. And all of his associates wouldn't even associate with women even in their dreams. Fear was put into everybody's heart. And everybody says, yes, yes, that's very good. Fear is very good. We must be afraid of doing the wrong thing, because if we do, we will lose the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. Even Vishnu Jan Swami. I wasn't particularly friends with him. I didn't particularly like him. That has nothing to do with this. He had a difficulty which caused him to fall into the category, as was stated in these books, of somebody who was to be condemned by Lord Chaitanya. And the only way to save himself from such eternal condemnation and gain the association of Lord Chaitanya again was to commit suicide. Now, do you think that was the message of Lord Chaitanya? It's up to you to decide. I interpret it quite differently. Somebody may say, I have my own personal reasons for doing so. I'm defending myself by creating this interpretation. You have a right to think like that. And it doesn't bother me if you think like that. That's simply your opinion. My opinion is within the context of my understanding of Lord Chaitanya's effect on the world. It's within the context of a very big picture, a global picture. That global picture is naturally something you would expect from Lord Chaitanya. Would you rather expect Lord Chaitanya to deal with little things, especially little things that nobody understood? And take my word for it, nobody understood this. At the time, his associates didn't understand it. The commentators didn't understand it. The present day people don't understand it. It's a mystery. I say put it in the context of Lord Chaitanya's overall effect on all of us, on effect on the world. It's not a mystery. It's another piece of the same understanding of the individual taking personal responsibility for what he will accept and what he will not accept and why. Now, you may wonder why Lord Chaitanya chose Chota Haridas, why he chose such an insignificant event. You can come up with your own conclusion. My conclusion is that if one of Lord Chaitanya's associates actually had a difficulty, Lord Chaitanya would not want to embarrass them because of it. And secondly, Lord Chaitanya's associates didn't have difficulties. So it was very difficult to find such an example. So therefore, an internal arrangement was made. And Lord Chaitanya chose this particular artificial, non-existent fault to bring out a point which would not germinate for hundreds of years. How many monolithic religions are based on the suppression of individuals because of their sins? The whole point of all these religions is you're going to burn in hell for being sinful. If no hell, then you're going to take birth again and again for being sinful. Or at the very least, you're not going to be respected. You're not going to get supported. And you're not going to be considered very important if you don't follow everything nicely and avoid to be sinful. Fame, profit, distinction. In other words, it's an essential aspect of a monolithic religion that you are sinful. Because without it, there'd be no need for religion. The religion depends on you being fallen and sinful. Isn't that interesting? Because if you weren't fallen and sinful, you wouldn't need to be under the control of the religion. You would think for yourself. You would say, that's not right. But I like that person. I don't like that person. That person's not acting in a way that I can respect or I want to be involved with. You wouldn't see people in terms of positions. You wouldn't see people in terms of reputations. You wouldn't see people in terms of the power they have. You wouldn't really see people in terms of what economic benefit they can give you. You would see people as people, as equal people. Because if you're not sinful and fallen, why do you have to think somebody's so much better than you? If somebody knows more and you want to learn it, you can be the student. You wouldn't say they're better. You would say they know more. And I'm going to learn it. And then when you became actually more knowledgeable, the teacher would say, wow, whew, what kind of seed I planted. There are many, many, many points which are so extraordinarily important. In Lord Chaitanya's life, Lord Chaitanya's words that have been lost for hundreds of years simply because of not understanding the global significance of Lord Chaitanya. In other words, by making Lord Chaitanya a Bengali avatar who appeared 500, they always say 500, although it's much more now, who appeared 500 years ago to spread the chanting of the holy name or to taste the love of Radhan. Limiting an avatar appeared then, did that. And if we do that like he did it then, we'll go there. So limiting. If you talk about Lord Chaitanya, actually as the Yuga avatar, means whatever you want to call a Yuga, whatever that means. You can say it's 437 or whatever thousand years. Give me a break. Some period of time, Lord Chaitanya has such an incredible global impact that the whole world is reverberating with his presence. It's a drop in the ocean that's spreading out in waves bigger and bigger and bigger. And like homeopathy, this very, shall we say, remote and seemingly light dosage is having a bigger and bigger effect day by day. That is a very nice way to talk about Lord Chaitanya. That's just my opinion. It's the way I see it. Believe it or not, I'm not asking you to believe it. But what I'm trying to show is how it works so that you can assemble it in your own consciousness in whatever way you want and use this kind of understanding in whatever way you want in your life. And this was the reason I gave that example. And I'm really sorry I forgot it myself during the lecture. I got so caught up in the example itself, I just forgot what it was all about. It's almost as if this example carries with it such confusion. It's like people have been so confused about this one event. Big commentators, big gurus, confused that this confusion is so huge that as soon as I started talking about it, I was feeding off of this confusion and I became confused. I forgot my point. But then I petted my cat and I played with my dog and I did a little exercise and all of a sudden the point came back to me and I wanted to share it with you. When I could push away the group's confusion and just come back to what I am as a person. Don't forget, there's a lot of power in confusion that's there when you have contacted a group, when these monolithic groups create these ideas and energies. We just embrace that confusion. We embrace that illusion. And it affects us so deeply down to the bottom of our heart that it's really hard to deal with it. I have the same problem. Hey, you think it's easy for me? You think talking contrary to everything that is going on, basically, in a religious tradition I embraced for more than 30 years, you think that's easy for me? You think it's easy for me to directly talk about things that have been stated unequivocally by hugely powerful spiritual people? Don't get me wrong. I'll never say these acharyas don't have power. These acharyas aren't intelligent. These acharyas aren't wonderfully spiritual people. I'll never say it because I don't believe it. I associated with them personally. Not all of them, but you know, quite a few significant ones. I know their power. I respect it. I don't happen to agree with the way they think. But do you know what it means to take that step? Do you know what it means to say, I don't agree with what you think, but I still love you? I don't agree with the way you speak about Lord Chaitanya. I don't agree with what you believe about Lord Chaitanya, but I still love you. I still respect you. I still appreciate you. And this is not just some words, New Age, alternative words. I really feel like that. But I'm not going to be under your control. And I'm not going to be, have my mind, shall we say, transformed into the way you want me to think. If you do, I'm going to think what I think, the way I think it. Because that I feel is Lord Chaitanya's gift. If I, as me, as what I am, embrace Lord Chaitanya for what is relevant to me, how can there be wrong in it? In fact, maybe it's the whole point. But I'm not going to say that. Who am I to say that? You have to decide that on your own. I made my own decisions. You make your own decisions. That's the whole point of what I'm saying. Lord Chaitanya made his own decision in relation to Chota Haridas. I say that's an example. If other people insist I change my mind, I have the right to say, you know, I don't want to be with you. I don't want to associate with you. You're agitating my mind. You're trying to push me to be something I'm not, to feel something I don't feel, to think something I don't think. You're making me think and feel a certain way, and if I don't, the subtle idea is there's something wrong with me. I say, you are giving me a headache, and I'm going to not associate with you. You think it's easy to say that? You know how much like therapy, work, internal transformation I had to go through to get to that point? It's easy, take my word for it. When you finally get mad enough to say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, I walk away. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. It's from a movie. It's from a very famous movie called Broadcast News. And anyway, it's a statement which kind of transformed the way people thought. I'm mad as hell, which means I'm burning mad and I'm not going to take it anymore. It kind of established the me generation of the 80s. But, you know, to come to that point, it's like when the pot is boiling and you're putting the lid on, and all of a sudden you explode. It's practically out of your control. It's not even like it's a great, courageous, conscious step. It's like you just flip out. You say, it's wrong, it's wrong. It's wrong. Damn it. It's wrong. It's like out of your control. It's not like I'm going to take a lot of credit. I blew up. You don't take credit for that. In fact, actually, you're an idiot for allowing yourself to be in this pressure cooker in the first place. That means you're an idiot. I was an idiot. Now, you know what it takes to get to the point of embracing that individuality, that I think like this. It's what I think. And if I disagree with you, if I think what you're saying just isn't right, I don't care who you are. I think differently. Yet I still love you. You know how long, what that takes to do that? You have to go through, when you explode, you have to go through this How could you have done this to me? That's really significant. How could you have done this to me? How could you have represented yourself in such a way and caused such a thing to happen? And how could all of you stupid people who are dealing with me in this way not understand what's really going on? How could you be so stupid? You have to go through all of these things, all of these stages. There are a lot more. I mean, I don't want to bore you. And finally, you get to the point where you make a full circle and you say, I don't agree with you. I don't accept what you think. I don't accept what you say. I don't accept what you've created. But I love you as a person because I know you as a person. I appreciate you as a person because I know you as a person. But I think differently. I feel differently. I act differently. I have different values. And above all, I see Lord Chaitanya very differently than you see him. Now, that doesn't mean there are like obvious external differences, but it means the import of events, the import of things which have been interpreted to fuel a monolithic empire of an organization, that these things are just improper, and I don't accept it. So now I'm going to get off of this very personal discussion I've been having and get into a more detached answering of questions. Now, somebody is worrying that, well, what's going to happen to me when I die? What's going to be the goal of my life? Am I saying that it's not to go back to Godhead? Is it not that I should remember the Supreme at the time of my death? Am I going to pass the test of life? Now, okay, let's take that point. If I'm transforming my life, if I'm accepting a transformation in my life, and I evolve, then as I come closer to my death, and as my body becomes less capable of expressing itself, even if I'm laying on my deathbed, I will embrace the energy of myself because it's basically all that I will have. I have seen a couple of people on their deathbeds, and even if they were very materialistic, their minds and consciousness transformed by their energy, and they became very much more interested in this energy level and the way in which it related to spirituality and what happens after death, because they're no longer so afraid of it that they can't talk about it. So as you evolve and as you become more conscious of your energy, you feel that connection with the Supreme. Yes, they're no longer afraid of death, of the death, before the death, because they're feeling very comfortable with their energy. So the idea that you evolve and you become connected with the divine energies in this lifetime, and you become attracted to them, you can walk up to deities and just say, I love you, and feel their love and love them. Naturally, your subconscious, unconscious, fundamental, and conscious desire will manifest as you are near death. Even if you've only got a second, it will turn instantly towards connecting again and going to those personalities you love so much. Those personalities you can stand before and say, I love you, and to feel their love. You will be drawn to them because it's the whole way your energy has been evolved. And exactly how, exactly where, and exactly what manner has a lot to do with your own energy and the way you've connected with them. So there's no contradiction between your former understanding and your present understanding. In any case, you don't even think differently. But if I were to explain it, it's just in different terminology. It's with a different slant. But it's the exact same essence that your soul reaches out to the Supreme. And naturally, when you're embracing the Supreme, you might not even notice that you've, quote unquote, died. You understand? Because you're in the embrace of the Supreme. I hope that answers the question. If not, let me know. We have a question here about instability. And actually, this is a very good question, because many of us have a very deep desire to have stability in our lives. As I mentioned before, I like stability. I like stability. I like things to be in a certain way. I like things to be dependable. I like dependable relationships. I don't like surprises. So how do people like me or you who've asked the question, how do we deal when we're living in a world of transits, transiting from one moment to the other, transiting from one situation to the other? Well, you can deal with it. It is possible. The way you can see it is like this, that there are certain basic fundamental things which are essential to us. For example, a living place. So we can have a stability in our living place. That means it's a physical location where these walls are always here. It doesn't matter if we put this wallpaper up, or we paint it that color, or we put a furniture, or we don't, because these things don't really have an impact on us, on our basic level of stability. They just make our living there better, or whatever. But if, for example, the pipes would break and water would be everywhere, this would affect that stability. So we have to make sure that any installation we do was proper so that we can maintain that stability of our living place. Similarly, we make sure we have food every day, so we make sure we have proper places to buy it. We have stability in water supply. We have stability in electrical supply. We have stability in sewage supply. And we can create stability in our families by working to be keeping, to keep all the relationships very, shall we say, fluid and full of that love which glues us all together. So the personal relationships are glued together by our love, by our commitment, by our responsibility, and that desire to keep it together. And then we would also have stability in our work, for instance, that we would not want to take up an occupation that would not have a stability for us. So we would look to work with a stable institution, or we would create our own, or with a stable kind of profession. And to do that, we would have to be happy with what we're doing. Because if we're not happy with what we're doing, then we wouldn't want to continue. Because you need to have this feeling of stability, and that only comes when you're happy with it. If you're not happy with where you live, then you're always wanting to find another place, so you don't feel stable. If you're not happy in your family, you may want to change it, and you won't feel stable. If you're not happy in your work, you want to find another work, and you're not feeling stable. So these things are essential. And we have to have that kind of stability in that way. So for those of us who wish to have stability in our lives, wish to have that feeling of basic fundamental existence, which is stable enough that we can bear to live, this is the way we do it. So I hope I've answered the question. I'm now going to get into another series of questions. Yes, these ideas of offenses are coming up. That the creation of offenses, the idea that there is something that you could do which would offend God, would offend others. This is a way in which you become bad. You see, that you make an offense, you become bad, you are therefore going to get reactions, and therefore to control you better, you have to stop making offenses, which means you have to act in the right way. And in this way, it's just a way to continue to keep everybody lined up in a certain way. And I don't think that if I see things differently, if my conclusion is different, that this is an offense. But if it is an offense for somebody to think differently than somebody else because of our relationship, then I must have the right to terminate that relationship, to terminate the conditions upon which that relationship was made, whereby this idea that my disagreement would be an offense. So that's within my right. And after doing that, I can again approach relationship without these terms and conditions. And that's a power also to the individual. But groups don't like that. And therefore, they say you cannot terminate. You cannot change these conditions. You agreed to them. It's a contract. It never changes. Interesting. Well, if you believe that, that's up to you. Another question. Why did Europe change more than India in the time of Lord Chaitanya? Maybe. I'll just throw this out. I don't know the answer. I'll just throw this out. Maybe Lord Chaitanya wanted everything to be global. Maybe he didn't want to be a Bengali avatar. Yes, maybe Lord Chaitanya didn't want to be a Bengali avatar. He wanted to be a global avatar. He didn't want to be a Bengali who influenced India. He wanted to be a global force. Can you imagine? Do you really think India can transform the world as Europe and then the transformation to America transformed the world? It's impossible. It's just not in the cultural or mentality or even the fact that other people around the world would respect it. Okay, maybe it might have been different, but Lord Chaitanya chose it this way. I say it was perfect because if you look at India, constantly conquered by Westernly forces, conquered by Turks, conquered by Persians, conquered by British, conquered by American capitalism. The whole of India is the support group now. It's becoming the support group for American kinds of technologies. If you call here to Dell Computer and you call for tech support, somebody who answers as Kevin or Ken or Sharon is going to be Ajit or actually Nirmala or whoever in Bangalore. They're just purely Indians trying to pretend that they're Westerners. So, okay, maybe that was the reason. I don't know. Maybe there was 100 other reasons. I just gave you some seed of how you could think about it and figure it out.